Yeremenko told him to get as many planes as possible into the air. The phone rang again. This time it was Nikita Khrushchev, calling from his downtown apartment. When Yeremenko told him the news, the commissar said he would come over as soon as he could. At 11 a.m., he was in the bunker, listening intently to Yeremenko's briefing. Shocked at the extent of the German drive, Khrushchev shook his head. "Very unpleasant facts," he said. "What can we do to keep them from Stalingrad?" Yeremenko told him how he was trying to juggle forces to the northern part of the city, and they discussed the problem of finding more reinforcements for the threatened suburbs. Everyone in the room was subdued, fully conscious that this might mean the fall of Stalingrad. They talked in low tones about the impact of such a calamity on the rest of the country. His hands sweating, Yeremenko tried to remain calm in front of his colleagues. When Major General Korshinov called with a report that the Germans had just burned a huge supply depot out on the steppe, Yeremenko lost his temper. Disgusted by Korshinov's hysterical tone, he shouted, "Carry on with your job! Stop this panic!" Then he hung up abruptly. Two generals walked into the bunker to announce that a new pontoon bridge, the only one connecting Stalingrad with the far shore, had just been completed. Yeremenko thanked them for working so hard, then told them to destroy it. The officers stared at each other in astonishment, wondering if Yeremenko suddenly had gone crazy. He repeated his instructions. "Yes, yes, I said to destroy it, and quickly!" When they still failed to react, he warned them that the bridge must not fall into German hands. The two generals left to carry out this draconian measure. Near the mouth of the Tsaritsa Gorge, boredom and the noontime humidity had brought out dozens of swimmers, like Lieutenant Viktor Nekrasov, who, with a friend, dove into the sun-streaked water and floated lazily in the current. Launches and steamers struggled past, and Nekrasov swam in their wake, listening contentedly to the guttural rumble of their diesel engines. When he tired, Nekrasov climbed from the water onto a pile of logs, where he stretched out to soak up the sun. With his eyes screwed up tight to shut out the brilliant light, he tried to imagine how the Volga compared with the Dnieper at his home in Kiev. The lieutenant decided that his river had been peaceful, a joyous place for children, and that the Volga was totally different, filled as it was now with clamorous boat traffic. Another thing bothered Nekrasov. Few bathers in Stalingrad smiled these days. As he dozed on into the afternoon, Nekrasov thought more and more about the Germans on the steppe, and he wondered what would happen to Stalingrad when the enemy finally reached the Volga. He could see himself crouching in the scrub grass on the far shore, while German shells blasted up huge fountains of water. 15 miles north of Nekrasov's lumber pile, the nightmare he envisioned had already begun. Machinist Lev Dailo had just met his first Germans. He tried to run, but was thrown to the ground and manhandled. One soldier snatched his watch, others prodded him to his feet and marched him across a field. Dailo waited until he saw a deep ravine, then plunged into it and escaped. The Germans did not shoot. Dailo ran 2 miles to the tractor works and burst in on his superiors. "They're here! Hurry!" he shouted, but the factory supervisors had already been alerted. The first battalions of workers' militia, some wearing uniforms but most in civilian clothes, were marching out to man barricades along the Mokraya-Machetka River. In factory courtyards up and down the main north-south highway in Stalingrad, political commissars and foremen processed thousands of workers for duty. They told each group, "Whoever can bear arms and whoever can shoot, write your names down." Those who signed got a white armband, a rifle, and a bandolier of ammunition before they moved off in platoons to the riverbank. Workers not selected went to the settlement houses to alert relatives of those who had gone into the lines. Pyotr Nerozia hurried home from one of these meetings at the Red October plant to say goodbye to his family, which was being evacuated that afternoon across the Volga. He arrived too late and found only a note saying that his wife and children had already left for Uralsk. Though relieved that they had gotten off safely, Pyotr felt a sudden loneliness. The stillness of the house bothered him, and he left for a walk. Near the aviation school, he stopped in a field, picked up a watermelon, then turned and went back home. In the kitchen, he started to fry 2 eggs. When another air raid alert sounded, Nerozia turned off the stove, left the two eggs in the pan, and went to the battalion headquarters of his workers' fighting detachment. The air raid siren that Nerozia reacted to was just another in the series of false alarms that Stalingrad residents had endured during the day. By late afternoon, the center of the city had lapsed into apathy. Incredibly enough, despite the presence of Yeremenko's nerve center in the Tsaritsa Gorge and the unusual military traffic on roads leading north to the factory area, most people in the downtown part of the city remained completely ignorant of the crisis. Lieutenant Viktor Nekrasov had finally gotten up from his comfortable log heap and, with his friend, wandered over to the main library at the river's edge. In the quiet and cozy reading room, he sprawled into a wicker chair and began to thumb through a magazine containing short articles on Peru. At a long table, two young boys laughed out loud at a book of drawings about Baron Munchausen. On the wall, a big clock struck each quarter hour. After a while, Nekrasov and his friend got up and left. Loudspeakers were spewing yet another warning across squares, intersections, and side streets. The voice minced no words. Attention, attention! Citizens, we have an air raid! We have an air raid! As if to underscore that it was not just another drill, anti-aircraft guns around Red Square banged loudly in frenzied cadence. Small black puffs marched across the clear blue sky. Automobiles quickly screeched to a halt. Tram cars let off passengers who stood mute for a moment, shaded their eyes, and looked into the sun to gauge the danger point. Then they saw them, the lead groups of more than 600 German planes, coming from beyond the Don. Like strings of gulls, flying in perfect Vs, the Stukas and Ju-88s droned over the sun-drenched city and tipped over into their dives. Their bombs fell into the crowded downtown residential area, and because of the long drought, flames spread like wildfire. In seconds, Stalingrad was ablaze. Concussions blew down most of the houses on Gogol and Pushkin streets. Outside a cinema, a woman was decapitated as she ran along the sidewalk. The city waterworks building collapsed from a direct hit. The telephone exchange fell in on itself. All regular phone communications blinked out. The screams of trapped operators came up through a jumble of broken switchboards and control panels. At Stalingrad Pravda, on the northern side of Red Square, bombs smashed the outer walls and brought survivors streaming out to seek safety in a nearby cellar. In the meantime, the loudspeakers on Red Square tonelessly asked people to shoulder arms and fight the invader. On Medvedevskaya Street, every house burned briskly. When firemen arrived, they saw a hysterical woman running down the middle of the road while clutching a baby tightly to her breast. One of the men jumped out, grabbed her, and pushed her down into a trench. A bomb went off, killing the man as he tried to get down beside her. On Permskaya Street, Mrs. Konstantin Karmanova returned home after seeing her two older sons march off with their factory unit. As she and her 16-year-old son Gen turned into the street, they saw the whole block burned out, except for their own home, a one-story brick dwelling. Mrs. Karmanova ran inside to save what she could. She grabbed a bundle of papers left by her husband when he went off to war. Some of them dated back to 1918, when he fought as a Bolshevik for Tsaritsyn. Rushing into the backyard, she dug a hole and buried the documents and some silver heirlooms. Around her, houses continued to burn. In Dargova, railroad man Konstantin Viskov woke from his drugged sleep to hear bombs crumping down near the train station. As he jumped out of bed, his wife handed him a package of food and kissed him goodbye. Viskov raced away through smoke and fire toward the terminal. The first bombs fell as Pyotr Nerozia unlocked the safe at battalion headquarters. His superior, a woman named Denisova, rushed in and told him to send guns to the tractor factory. After issuing orders for their transfer, Nerozia reminded himself to go home and pick up some food. Outside the headquarters, the city shook in agony. Smoke pouring through the windows choked him, and suddenly he was thirsty. Comrade Denisova grabbed at his arm and pointed to the main hospital, which collapsed while they watched. Running over to help the patients, they shepherded a group onto the nearby children's clinic, but it caught fire immediately, and the invalids inside were roasted to death. Nerozia then went off to assemble a workers' detachment at the factory Krasny Zastava. It was a mass of flames. He moved on to the city Soviet at Red Square, but it too had flared and broken under a string of bombs. He ran ahead to the metro, a cavernous underground air raid shelter, now crammed with screaming and suffocating people. Nerozia balked at going into this hellhole and, remembering the food at home, circled back to his own street, where his house was still standing. Going to the bedroom, he found his parrot squawking for attention as it hopped frantically about its cage. Taking the trembling bird in his hands, he held it at the window and released it into gray clouds of smoke. The parrot flew off and flitted nervously from tree to tree. Nerozia watched his pet for a moment, then ran back to the kitchen and filled a bedsheet with farina, wheat grain, dried bread, and a bottle of vodka. When he finished, he gazed wistfully at the stove where his two fried eggs lay under a coverlet of fallen plaster. With a final shrug, he hoisted the sack of rations onto his shoulder and left his house for the last time. At 7 p.m., during the height of the bombing, the city Soviet leaders managed to function from an improvised network of cellars. They sent out orders to continue publication of Pravda, and Mikhail Vodolagin, a thick-lipped, bespectacled member of the Central Committee, hurried over to Pravda headquarters on Red Square and found the entire building a shambles. A few hundred yards away, he stumbled on the newspaper staff, cowering in a basement and too stunned to work. Vodolagin commandeered a car and went north toward the tractor factory, which he knew had a printing press. The trip normally took 20 minutes, but with German planes overhead and bodies and debris clogging the main road, the passage was torturous. To Vodolagin's right, liquid fire from ruptured oil tanks passed down the slope and spilled into the Volga. To his left, the lower slopes of Mamaev Hill were covered with the bodies of picnickers. After two harrowing hours, Vodolagin arrived at the nearly deserted tractor works. He found his printing press, collared a militiaman who said he knew how to set type, and, as plaster fell from the ceiling, he started to bring out a special issue of Pravda. Close to 9 p.m., with the Stukas and Ju-88 still overhead, Mrs. Vlasa Kliagina hurried back from digging ditches in Yelshenka. She was anxious to find her daughter Nadia, who had gone home early to be with little Vovo. At a roadblock, Mrs. Kliagina fretted impatiently until a soldier finally waved her through into her own neighborhood, crackling from 100 fires. She ran along Sovietskaya Street and turned into Karl Marx Gardens, where thousands of people huddled around benches. Homeless, crying, many had already lost relatives. Mrs. Kliagina searched for her children, but did not find them in the crowd. When she came to her own home, her heart sank. It was a smoldering ruin. She called out several times, but no one answered, and she fled down Komsomolskaya Street. A friend saw her there, sobbing incoherently, and shouted that Nadia was safe in a nearby cellar. At that moment, her daughter ran out and told her mother that Vovo had vanished. Mrs. Kliagina refused to believe her and broke away, screaming, "Vovo, Vovo, where are you?" She never saw him again. In his diary that evening, the aggressive, flamboyant Luftwaffe general Freiherr von Richthofen summed up the results of his pilots' operations over the stricken city. A sudden alert sent out by 8th Air Corps put the whole of Air Fleet 4 into the air, with the result that we simply paralyzed the Russians. It was true. The city's pulse slowed, numbed by the blows that had killed nearly 40,000 people. Close to midnight, with the Tsaritsa Gorge completely ringed by fire, a bone-tired General Yeremenko picked up the Bodo conference phone to speak with Stalin. Within minutes, the premier was on the line, listening as Yeremenko confessed that the situation was very bad, so bad that city officials wanted to blow up some of the factories and transfer the contents of others across the Volga. The general stressed, however, that both he and Commissar Khrushchev opposed such a move. Stalin was furious. "I do not want to debate this question," he shouted. "The evacuation and mining of the plants will be interpreted as a decision to surrender Stalingrad. Therefore, the State Defense Committee forbids it." With this order, Stalin left Yeremenko to cope with the Germans, knocking at the city gates. Chapter 7. According to the tactics devised by General Paulus, the three German divisions crossing the steppe on Sunday, August 23rd, were supposed to forge a 40-mile-long corridor from the Don to the Volga. This barrier of steel would seal off Stalingrad from the north and prevent reinforcements from filtering down to the aid of the city. In theory, the plan was sound. In practice, it required perfect coordination among the participating units. By midnight of August 23rd, the 16th Panzer Division on the outskirts of Stalingrad had outrun its support. 12 miles to its rear, the 3rd Motorized Division halted for the night. Another 10 miles back, the 60th Motorized Division had bogged down in a giant traffic snarl. Completely separated from each other, the three divisions became a chain of islands dropped in the middle of a hostile sea. Until these islands joined into a solid land bridge extending outward from the main body of the 6th Army, each would be extremely vulnerable to Soviet counterattacks. While the Russian military council in Stalingrad dispatched the workers' militia to trenches north of the tractor works, General Hans Huber ordered his 16th Panzers into a circular defense perimeter, a hedgehog, with the division's heavy artillery covering a 360-degree front. At the same time, Huber issued instructions for an immediate attack if there was any opportunity to take advantage of tactical surprise. At 4:40 the next morning, his gun batteries opened a furious barrage on Russian positions around Spartakovka and the Mokraya Machetka River. Shortly afterward, panzers of Combat Group Krumpen roared out from the hedgehog onto the softened targets, only to run into withering fire from hastily fortified Soviet trenches. In a miracle of overnight organization, Russian militia had dug interlocking strong points and assimilated the rudiments of modern warfare. Now, dressed in work clothes or Sunday finery, they crouched behind mortars and machine guns and challenged the finest tank army in the world. When Combat Group Krumpen staggered under their hail of shells, the Russians even opened a counterattack, sending unpainted T-34 tanks straight from the factory assembly lines at the Germans. The situation suddenly reversed. General Huber radioed 6th Army headquarters for information about his tardy supporting divisions. They, too, were under heavy pressure. The 3rd Motorized at the town of Kuzmichi had just captured a Soviet freight train bulging with American Ford trucks and Willys Jeeps, but it had to turn into its own hedgehog formation to face a reckless onslaught by the Russian 35th Guards Division, which was pouring down from the north to widen the gap between the 3rd and 60th Motorized to the west. Led by packs of tanks, Red Army soldiers spilled across the steppe and descended on the flanks of both divisions. Unaware of the situation, Dr. Otmar Kohler tended to his patients at a makeshift hospital along a railroad siding, 25 miles west of the Volga. He was still in great pain from the broken jaw he had sustained the day before in the motorcycle accident. Unable to eat properly, he was living on chocolate and cognac. To keep his loose upper jaw in place, Kohler worked with a piece of cork clenched in his mouth. As the surgeon concentrated on an operation, a soldier yelled into the operating room, "The Russians have broken through!" Kohler kept working and, when he finished, went to the door to see several Soviet tanks squashing German vehicles only 100 yards away. The sight brought a roar from his throat. Spitting out the cork, he screamed, "Load the wounded!" At that instant, concealed German anti-aircraft guns fired ear-splitting salvos directly at the enemy tanks, which blew up and scattered flaming fuel and bodies across the ground. The shooting increased as other Russian tanks came to duel with the German artillery. Rooted to the doorway, Kohler noticed a German sergeant and his 6-man squad walking unconcernedly around the corner of the hospital. Trailing their guns in the dirt, the soldiers came up to him and the sergeant asked, "What the hell's going on around here?" In reply, the astonished Kohler asked his own question, "What the hell are you going to do about it?" The sergeant shrugged in indifference and begged to be allowed to rest. When Kohler looked into the man's eyes, he held his temper, for it was clear to him the soldier had just undergone a harrowing experience. In the midst of the earth-shaking shelling, he ordered food and rum for his guests. They stretched out against a wall and watched the battle escalate. Hundreds of Russian troops were marching toward them across a grassy field. Their arms linked together, they were singing songs in loud harmony. When the sergeant stopped eating, he wiped his hands on his uniform and told Kohler he was ready for orders. The doctor suggested that the squad do a little fighting and asked the name of the sergeant's commanding officer. "Captain Holland," he said, adding in a hollow voice that Holland's head had just been shot off by a Russian tank. Kohler knew now what haunted the sergeant, so he left him alone, jumped on a pile of manure, and trained his binoculars on the incredible parade coming at him from the meadow. Behind him, a German staff car careened into the yard, and an officer standing in the back seat hollered, "Just what in hell is going on around here?" Used to that question by now, Kohler merely waved a greeting. "Come on up on my manure pile and see for yourself." Giving the officer his glasses, he pointed to the enemy infantry. The man swore in delight, handed back the binoculars, raced to his car, and sped off toward an artillery command post. Kohler fixed his attention on the marching soldiers, whose songs drifted toward him on the balmy summer breeze. As the doctor stared in horrified fascination, geysers of earth suddenly blossomed among them, and jagged holes appeared where men had been moments before. Kohler watched as the steppe grass turned red and the singing was replaced by the shrieks of the dying. Sickened by the slaughter, the doctor lowered the glasses, climbed down off the dung heap, and went to care for his own wounded. Bending over the operating table, he carefully put another cork in his mouth to keep his throbbing jaw in place. 20 miles southwest of Ottmar Kohler's dispensary, 6th Army Commander Friedrich von Paulus read the radio messages from his 3 divisions on the steppe and lost his initial exuberance over the lightning victory of the previous day. He now faced the chilling prospect of losing one or more of these units unless he could send enough reinforcements and supplies to help them forge that barrier of steel to the Volga. As a precautionary measure, Paulus alerted the Luftwaffe to begin dropping ammunition and food into the most distant of the islands, General Huba's 16th Panzer Hedgehog at the outskirts of Stalingrad. Meanwhile, the general wondered how he was going to take that city in the next 24 hours, as Hitler expected him to do. At dawn, the city of Stalingrad looked as though a giant hurricane had lifted it into the air and smashed it down again in 1,000,000 pieces. The downtown section was almost flat, with nearly 100 blocks still engulfed by raging fires. With the waterworks broken, firemen could only try to care for the victims of the Holocaust. On a street beside the black walls of the NKVD prison, a rescue team worked feverishly to extricate a young woman, Nina Detrunina, whose legs had been pinned under tons of masonry. Their job was complicated by the ominous creaking of the prison walls, weakened dangerously by a near miss. While men and women gingerly removed brick after brick, a doctor knelt to give morphine to Nina, who smiled gratefully at her saviors. Not long after the last of the stones had been removed and Nina was taken to a hospital, she died from internal injuries. In a deep balka, a group of naked adults wandered helplessly through the smoke. Inmates from the insane asylum, they were unable to comprehend the new nightmare in which they existed. On flame-blackened sidewalks, Komsomol boys and girls helped people pick through bodies to find their kin. When anyone recognized a family member, the volunteers acted quickly to ease the shock by embracing the survivor. One woman did not need their solace. She spent hours turning over the bodies, rejecting them, and moving on until she found her infant, who had been mangled by a bomb. The woman stooped, gathered the remains in her arms, and rocked the baby tenderly for some time. As a Komsomol worker edged closer to comfort her, he heard the woman speaking to the dead child. In a scolding tone, she asked, "How am I going to explain this to your father when he comes home from the war?" Komsomol director Anastasia Modina spent most of her time rounding up hundreds of orphans, most of whom just sat beside the bodies of their parents and stared at the mutilated figures. Some children spoke to the dead, trying to rouse them. Others smoothed the victims' torn clothing as if to make them all better. Anastasia went to the children, took them by the hand, and led them away to the evacuation shelter at the Volga. Some balked at leaving the bodies of their parents, but she talked to them, and they listened while tears ran down their faces. Eventually, most of them reached up to the lady with the soothing voice. but a few steadfastly refused to move from the cadavers. Anastasia left them alone. She had too many others to care for. At the main ferry, thousands of frightened civilians milled restlessly around the pier, while grim-faced NKVD police tried to hold them in check. Many were leaving loved ones behind, either dead in their homes or working as essential personnel in the factories. On the embankment under the cliff, the evacuees scribbled notes and tacked them to trees or the sides of buildings. "Mama, we are all right. Look for us at Biktavka." Klava. "Don't worry, Vanya. We have gone to Astrakhan. Come to us." Yuri. Out on the Volga, battered tugs and steamers steered carefully around the northern tip of Golodny Island and edged in toward the landing. Docked amid a cacophony of whistles, they heeled over badly from the weight of passengers running up the gangplanks. When the boats cast off and reversed course for the far shore, the departing Stalingraders waved sorrowfully at the retreating shoreline of the city they had once called home. Overhead, German reconnaissance planes wove back and forth, noting the chaotic scene at the ferry and radioing the information back to their bases at Morozovskaya and Tatsinskaya on the steppe. A quarter mile west of the central landing on the Volga, Andrei Yeremenko juggled his reserves to contain General Hans Huba's 16th Panzers in the northern suburbs. When Colonel Semyon Gorokhov stepped ashore with his 6,000-man brigade, he thought he was supposed to take them to fight on the southern fringes of the city. Instead, Yeremenko sent him north to the tractor factory to build a line girdling that plant. Another group, Marines from the Soviet Far East Fleet, piled into a convoy of automobiles for a breakneck trip past Mamayev Hill to the trenches along the Makraya-Machetka River, a mile above the tractor works. The Marines rode to battle, with their rifles sticking out the car windows. One traveler to the factory complex was Georgi Malenkov, Stalin's personal watchdog in Yeremenko's headquarters. If the general was nervous with Malenkov peering over his shoulder, Nikita Khrushchev was more so, for he and Malenkov were bitter rivals in the murderous world of Kremlin politics. Khrushchev knew that he had lost favor with Stalin because of his partial responsibility for the disastrous spring offensive at Kharkov, which had resulted in the loss of more than 200,000 Red Army troops. A master of intrigue himself, he realized that Malenkov would gladly report any of his mistakes to the premier. Malenkov had gone to the tractor factory, where, under a broiling sun, his face flushed and hair hanging in wet strands, he exhorted the plant personnel to hold on until more help arrived. He spoke with great fervor, while the pounding guns from the battle around Spartakovka to the north punctuated his sentences. After Malenkov finished speaking, the workers dispersed to their cavernous shops. Inside one of the rooms, Mikhail Vodolagin had finally brought out the emergency edition of Pravda, 500 single-sheet copies that he rushed out to the population with instructions to pass them on after reading. The main point of Vodolagin's special issue was to instill a sense of continuity, a feeling that the city was still functioning and would survive. He made an urgent appeal for everyone to stay calm and not to give in to panic. His editorial proclaimed, "We will destroy the enemy at the gates of Stalingrad." While the fledgling publisher moved his printing operations further south to the less threatened Red October plant, civilian militia and regular troops rushed past the tractor factory toward the Mokraya-Machetka River, where German combat groups were trying to overrun the stubborn Russian amateurs. The only German success had been the capture of the Trans-Volga ferry terminus for the railroad to Kazakhstan. Around the approaches to the factories of Stalingrad, they had met constant and bloody rebuffs. One Russian woman, Olga Kovalova, dominated a section of the defenses protecting the tractor factory. Stalking the line, her head wrapped in a gaily colored kerchief, she screamed invective at militiamen whom she found derelict, clumsy, or incompetent. The men were used to her rough language. Olga had worked with them for 20 years, during which time she had become the first woman steel founder in the Soviet Union. Gruff and earthy, she had earned their respect and devotion. Her battalion commander, Sazakin, heard Olga badgering the workers and tried to get her out of the dangerous sector. "Olga," he implored, "this is no place for a woman. Go back where you belong." When she failed to respond, he ordered her to leave. Olga turned, fixed him with a malevolent stare, and answered, "I'm not going anywhere." Sazakin threw up his hands and left her alone. Hours later, he spied a colorful splotch of clothing in a clump of high grass and went to investigate. He found Olga lying on her back, the bright kerchief smeared with blood. Her left eye was missing. She had been dead for some time. Once again, the Germans tried to stampede the civilian population. The Stukas came back to bomb the jammed embankment beside the main ferry landing. With no place to hide, the masses there weaved back and forth like a pendulum, first close to the cliff wall for shelter, and then out again when the Stukas drove past. Clusters of bombs found them, and the shoreline was slippery with blood. Medical teams pulled the dead from the footpaths as the living pushed each other onto the boats that were to evacuate them. But the Stukas were sighting on them, too. They dropped to 100-foot altitudes and machine-gunned the vessels. In the hazy sunlight of the warm afternoon, the Volga erupted in a chain of fierce explosions, and several boats of the rescue fleet broke apart and sank, with almost no survivors. The surface of the river was soon dotted with bodies, bobbing lazily in the current that carried them downstream to a rendezvous with the Caspian Sea. There was no change in the pattern of fighting during the next 3 days. The Germans tried to consolidate their gains. Yaremenko's troops fought desperately to hold their positions to the north and south of the city, but it was becoming increasingly clear that drastic measures would have to be taken if Stalingrad was to be saved. The pressure of the German assaults was wearing down the defenders. Late in the evening of August 27th, a Red Army staff car sped from Moscow's Vnukovo airport across the city to the Kremlin. Inside sat Marshal Georgi Konstantinovich Zhukov, a barrel-chested 46-year-old peasant. No stranger to crisis, in 1939 Zhukov had faced a surprise Japanese attack at the Khalkhin Gol in Manchuria and won a tremendous victory over the vaunted Kwantung Army. That triumph earned him promotion at a time when Stalin was killing 50% of his Red Army officer corps in an orgy of paranoia. In September 1941, when Nazi tanks ringed Leningrad, Stalin sent him there to mastermind the defense. Zhukov raged around that city, executing derelict officers, sacking generals, molding a rigid discipline which helped the people of Leningrad brace and hold. Later, Zhukov again plunged into battle, this time in front of Moscow, where enemy panzers had broken through on the road from Smolensk and precipitated a disorderly evacuation of the capital by many government employees. Zhukov toured the lines, rallying demoralized divisions and creating an elastic defense which, when aided by the advent of a brutal winter, crippled the Wehrmacht west of Moscow. Now Stalin needed his special talents in the struggle for the Volga. Surrounded by members of Stavka, the premier greeted Zhukov somberly and filled him in on developments around Stalingrad. Then he ordered the marshal to take personal charge of overall strategy in that crucial region. During the dinner that followed, Stalin outlined the temporary measures he had introduced to harass the enemy. He was bringing elements of three armies, the First Guards, the 24th and 66th, against the fragile blocking corridor the Germans had created from the Don to the Volga. But these piecemeal attacks had proven ineffectual, Stalin admitted. He wanted Zhukov to find a workable solution. Before the two men parted, Stalin told him he was giving him a new title, Deputy Supreme Commander of the Red Army, which made Zhukov second only to Stalin in rank. As the marshal prepared for his trip, he could not know that the first problem he would have to solve was the accelerating breakdown in morale among Russian troops. Few Russian soldiers believed the Germans could be stopped short of the Volga. Defeatism infected the conversations of both headquarters staffs and enlisted men. The Germans themselves were amazed at the torrent of prisoners coming into their lines. OKW in East Prussia received a cable from 6th Army stating that the battle value of enemy soldiers was judged to be very poor. Many deserters, some even coming in with their tanks. Inside the perimeter of the newly arrived Soviet 64th Division, stationed 25 miles due north of Stalingrad, morale was particularly bad. A German air raid had leveled the field hospital, killing many of its nurses and doctors. Wounded men back from the battlefield told horrifying stories of enemy superiority, and these tales spread fear among the inexperienced troops. They started to slip away singly, in pairs, and finally in large groups. With the division on the verge of dissolution before ever seeing combat, its commanding officer acted decisively to curb the epidemic. Calling a general assembly of regiments, he stood before them and berated them for shirking their duties to the motherland. The colonel charged his men with the same guilt as those who had already run off and told them he intended to punish them for cowardice. His harangue ended, the colonel moved purposefully to the long lines of massed soldiers. A pistol in his right hand, he turned at the end of the first row and began counting in a loud voice. 1, 2, 3, 4. As he reached the 10th man, he wheeled and shot him in the head. As the victim crumpled to the ground, the colonel picked up the count again. 1, 2, 3. At 10, he shot another man dead and continued his dreadful monologue. 1, 2. No one bolted. Nurses standing beside the formation sucked in their breath at the macabre scene. The colonel's mournful voice stabbed at the troops. 6, 7. Men mentally guessed their place in line and prayed the colonel would finish before he got to them. When the last bullet in the revolver thudded into a man's brain, the commander shoved the pistol back in his holster and walked away. An officer bellowed, "Dismiss!" The order ricocheted across the parade field. The soldiers broke from formation and scattered in all directions. Behind them, 6 of their comrades lay in a neat pattern on the grass. Less than 20 miles south of this grotesque ceremony, the Germans clinging to the 16th Panzer Division Hedgehog at the Volga faced annihilation. A 14th Corps officer put it succinctly when he complained to Paulus, "If this situation continues, I can name the exact day when we will cease to exist." He was complaining about the supplies that were still blocked by Soviet interference. A 500-car freight train finally broke past Russian rail blocks on August 28th to deliver ammunition and food to the surrounded tankers. Its timely arrival saved the fiery General Huba an embarrassing moment. He had just agreed with irate staff members to pull back from the Volga and try to reach 6th Army's main lines back at the Don. In 5 days of fighting against the factory workers of Stalingrad, Huba had not been able to reach the tractor plant. But now, replenished with artillery and mortar shells, the general turned his heavy weapons back on the militia holding the Balkas at the northern border of the city. In his underground bunker at Tsaritsa Gorge, Andrei Yeremenko scanned his maps, which told an ugly story. On his right flank, he had held Huba at bay with a motley collection of civilians and military units. But Stalin's attempts to interdict the German corridor had failed, and the 3rd Motorized Division had finally linked up with the 16th Panzers to seal off an 18-mile stretch of steppe running from the Don to Stalingrad. Also, the 60th Motorized Division bringing up the rear was about to complete the junction of the German islands and completely block any further penetrations by Soviet troops coming down from the north to reinforce the city. In the center of Yeremenko's front, the main body of Paulus's 6th Army was massing for a broad sweep over the steppe from Kalach east to the very heart of Stalingrad. And to hold this region, Yeremenko could count at best 25,000 combat soldiers, the remnants of the battered 62nd Army, which was virtually destroyed in the Germans' pincers in early August beyond the Don. Over on his left flank, southwest of the city, Yeremenko looked with some satisfaction at the defense line he had engineered in the low hills from Abgenerovo on to Tinguda and Tundutovo. The line had brought German General Papa Hote to the verge of apoplexy as Russian anti-tank guns pummeled his armor and decimated his grenadiers. But Yeremenko could not afford to relax about the situation there. In recent hours, his intelligence had noted an ominous series of complicated troop movements behind the German lines. Opinion in the Tsaritsa Gorge was divided, but Yeremenko guessed that Hote had lost patience with frontal assaults and was attempting to outflank the hill line, creating another pincers with Paulus in order to trap both the 62nd and 64th Red Armies outside Stalingrad. If he succeeded, the battle for Stalingrad would end within days. Yeremenko was right but only to a degree. Haut had lost patience with the discouraging and costly direct approach to Stalingrad. With a swollen casualty list preying on his mind, he formulated a radical maneuver, a sideslip around the enemy. Pulling his tanks and armored infantry out of the line by night, he regrouped them 30 miles to the west. To confound Russian spies, he replaced the withdrawn divisions with new units to maintain a semblance of continuity. But Holt's plans were not as grandiose as Yeremenko envisioned, at least not in the beginning. The horse-faced general merely wanted to roll up the Russian hill system from the flank and, given extraordinary luck, perhaps pin the Russian 64th Army against the Volga, south of Stalingrad. On the evening of August 29th, Haut unleashed his panzers north through Avgenerovo and onto the steppe for 20 incredible miles. The thrust confirmed Yeremenko's opinion that Haut intended to meet Paulus out on the steppe, and he quickly authorized the painful withdrawal of his divisions from their positions south and southwest of the city. Unlike previous Soviet command decisions of the first months of the war, this one would save whole armies for another day, even though it entailed the possible loss of Stalingrad. The retreat wrought terrible confusion. At 10 p.m. that same day, the Russian 126th Division received its order to pull back. When some regiments left ahead of others, a headlong flight began. Flanking divisions melted into the night. On the morning of August 30th, the German 29th Motorized Division intercepted thousands of enemy soldiers wandering the steppe. The commander of the Russian 208th Division surrendered with his entire staff. Trucks, tanks, and hundreds of artillery pieces dropped into German hands without a fight. Papa Haut had unlocked the door to Stalingrad. Astounded at the sudden Russian collapse, he revised his goals and now sought what Yeremenko had mistakenly believed he always planned to do. He sent his panzers north to meet Paulus's tanks coming from the corridor to the Volga. Army Group B headquarters informed Friedrich von Paulus of the golden opportunity offered by the bold gambit. In view of the fact that 4th Panzer Army gained a bridgehead at Gavrilovka at 1000 hours today, everything now depends on 6th Army concentrating the strongest possible forces and launching an attack in a generally southerly direction. Inexplicably, Paulus did not move. Harried by the suicidal Russian attempts to break his thin corridor to the Volga, he refused to rush troops south for a link-up. Crucial hours passed. Another urgent cable went out to Paulus. Again, he failed to respond. And while the German high command tried to move its pincers, Andrei Yeremenko pulled back more than 20,000 Russian soldiers on the steppe between the Don and Stalingrad. Ever since he had ordered the destruction of the bridge at Kalach, Colonel Pyotr Ilyin had held his position in the orchard on the southeastern edge of the town. With his ammunition running low and only 100 men left in his command, he had been unable to keep the Germans from crossing the Don by boat. During this period, he had not received any new orders, but on the night of August 28th, the Stalingrad radio finally contacted him. A hesitant voice from 62nd Army headquarters asked, "Is that you, Comrade Ilyin? Where are you?" "Yes, it's me. We're in Kalach." "In Kalach? The Germans are there." The voice was incredulous. Ilyin tried to explain how he was still holding out, even though Captain Gerhard Münch's battalion had forded the Don and seized the old part of the town. The voice on the radio told him to wait a minute. Ilyin listened to the static. Then the voice on the radio came back with another question. "Tell me, Comrade Ilyin, where is your command post?" Realizing the voice was trying to trap him, he immediately pinpointed his location and was showered with congratulations for fighting so well. Then headquarters broke off the conversation. 3 nights later, as Yeremenko began disengaging his troops from the steppe, the voice called Ilyin again and told him to give up the orchard and make a run for the Volga. Within hours, his brigade stole out of Kalach in a 38-truck convoy. When the Germans sensed movement in the dark, they blazed away at the sound, and Ilyin stood in the road, exchanging shots with München's battalion. Then he leaped into a car and rode off safely to Stalingrad. On September 2nd, Paulus finally agreed to the southward drive toward Haut, and within hours, the jaws of the pincers snapped shut. But Paulus had waited too long. Most of the Russian troops on the steppe had escaped into Stalingrad, and his 72 hours of indecision had given the enemy another chance to fight. Now, the battle would be in the streets of Stalingrad, where blitzkrieg tactics were useless. Chapter 8. On September 3rd, Joseph Stalin sent a telegram to Marshal Zhukov at Malaya Ivanovka, on the western bank of the Volga, 50 miles due north of Stalingrad. The situation at Stalingrad has deteriorated further. The enemy stands 2 miles from the city. Stalingrad may fall today or tomorrow if the northern group of forces does not give immediate assistance. See to it that the commanders of forces north and northwest of Stalingrad strike the enemy at once. No delay can be tolerated. To delay now is tantamount to a crime. In the 5 days he had been at the front, Zhukov had not yet performed a miracle, but he was attempting to coordinate Russian infantry attacks with meager air and tank strikes. Such an effort needed time. This Stalin would not allow him. When Zhukov called him, pleading for a delay until ammunition arrived in sufficient quantities, Stalin gave him until September 5th. On that day, Zhukov launched human wave assaults, which crashed into the left flank of the German corridor, from the Don to the Volga, and immediately foundered. At nightfall, the German corridor was still intact. Zhukov phoned Stalin with the bad news. After describing the carnage, he mentioned that Paulus had been forced to transfer some reserves from the outskirts of Stalingrad to contain him. Stalin was elated. "That's very good," he said. "It is of great help to the city." When Zhukov cautioned that the Russian success was illusory, the premier dismissed it, saying, "Just continue the attacks. Your job is to divert as many of the enemy forces as possible from Stalingrad." With that, Stalin hung up. Adolf Hitler, the other grand chess master in the fateful game, paced the fragrant pine woods of Vinnytsia in growing frustration. He could not understand why the goals of Operation Blue had not been met. General Paulus had hit the Volga on August 23rd, but Stalingrad had not yet fallen, and in the Caucasus, where Army Group A strove for the prized oil fields, something else was going wrong. Ever since the Germans had turned the corner at Rostov on July 23rd and burst into the landmass between the Black Sea and the Caspian, the Russians had played a skillful game of will-o'-the-wisp, drawing the Nazis further and further from their supply bases. The German grenadiers of the 1st Panzer and 17th Armies crossed parched desert, fields of 6-foot-high sunflowers, and on August 9th, finally came to the foothills of the Caucasus Mountains, where they captured the oil center of Maikop, only to find it burned to the ground by retreating Russians. Hitler then urged his commanders on toward Grozny, Batum, and Baku. Along the way, they acquired new allies: Moslems, Circassians, natives who rejected communist rule. Still, the Germans never trapped a large body of the Red Army. By September, with supply lines sluggish, their march toward the chief oil centers slowed. When Army Group A's commander, Marshal List, recommended regrouping, Hitler went into a tirade and threatened to fire him. In the daily staff meetings with his conscience, the stubborn General Franz Halder, Hitler bridled under repeated warnings about weak flanks and poor communications both at Stalingrad and in the Caucasus. He began to think about replacing Halder, too. The situation deteriorated further on September 7th when General Alfred Jodl returned from a hurried trip to the Caucasus headquarters and heartily endorsed List's idea of ending all attacks until Army Group A was resupplied with men and materiel. Hitler exploded at this defection by a trusted aide. He screamed at Jodl, who also lost his temper and shouted back stinging reminders of Hitler's various directives that had brought the operation to its present sorry state. His face blotched and his eyes feverish, the Führer stormed out of the meeting. From that moment on, the breach between him and the Wehrmacht generals widened irreparably. Until the end of the war, whenever he stayed at the OKW, Hitler took almost all his meals alone, except for the companionship of his dog, Blondie. While the leader of the Third Reich sulked at Vinnytsia, his pawns in the 4th Panzer Army were storming the southern outskirts of Stalingrad. After meeting Paulus's 6th Army on the steppe just outside the city, Papa Hote wheeled his divisions eastward, for a drive to the Volga that hopefully would split the 62nd and 64th Soviet armies. But the moment his tanks rolled off the steppe into the congested hilly suburban towns of Krasnormysk and Kuporosnoy, Haut faced a different kind of war. Gone were the lightning 10-mile advances. Now Haut settled for only a mile or two each day. When the panzers bogged down in narrow streets, Russian soldiers doused them with Molotov cocktails. From windows, enemy snipers picked off whole squads of unwary foot soldiers. Artillery, once used to decimate unseen targets miles away, was now employed to rip out the guts of buildings just 50 yards in front of stalled German divisions. The cost was frightful. Werner Halle, a corporal in the 71st Regiment of the 29th Motorized Division, later wrote in his diary, "During this period, we were frequently without company commanders or even platoon leaders. Each one of us, this may sound hard, but this was the way it was, could easily guess that he might be the next to go." On the evening of September 9th, Halle and his men received a warm meal, their first in many days. The next day, he stood on the slopes leading down to the Volga at Kuporosnoy and marveled that he had made it to this huge river. After sending word back of his triumph, he dug in quickly to await a violent Soviet reaction to his presence. Halle's arrival at the Volga marked the final isolation of the Russian 62nd Army. Already cut off in the north by the German 6th Army's push to the Volga on August 23rd, it was now penned into a salient around the suburb of Biktavka and was about to absorb the full weight of Friedrich von Paulus's main body, drawn up at the western rim of Stalingrad. The 62nd Army was now the only combat force left to deny Stalingrad to more than 200,000 invaders. In the Tsaritsa Gorge, traffic around the Russian military council bunker was unusually light. Civilians who commented on the hushed atmosphere were unaware that General Andrei Yeremenko had moved out across the river to Yami. Yeremenko's reasons for leaving were legitimate. He had trouble communicating with his armies over phone wires, which were constantly being cut by enemy fire, and German mortars were shelling the Tsaritsa Gorge itself. Only a few days before, flames from a burning oil dump had poured down the gorge and almost incinerated the headquarters. When Nikita Khrushchev phoned Stalin to explain why they wanted to leave, the premier fumed, "No, that's impossible. If your troops find out that their commander had moved his headquarters out of Stalingrad, the city will fall." Khrushchev kept repeating the arguments until Stalin relented. "Well, all right. If you're certain that the front will hold and our defenses won't be broken, I'll give you permission." The headquarters staff crossed the Volga on September 9th, and before he left, Khrushchev called in bald-headed General F.I. Golikov and told him to stay as liaison with General Alexander Ivanovich Lopatin, commander of the sacrificial 62nd Army. Golikov turned white as a sheet and begged Khrushchev not to abandon him. "Stalingrad is doomed," he begged. "Don't leave me behind. Don't destroy me. Let me go with you." Khrushchev brusquely ordered Golikov to pull himself together, then stalked out of the bunker to catch the ferry to the far shore. Chapter 9. General Golikov's hysteria reflected the increasing tendency among Soviet personnel to quit the city. While Golikov was forced to remain because of a direct order from Khrushchev, thousands of Russian officers and men sought safety on the eastern shore of the Volga. Some forged false papers, others hid on the ferries. All were desperate enough to chance a fatal encounter with NKVD police. But even the green hats were now leaving. At his nearly deserted bunker in the Tsaritsa Gorge, General Lopatin tried valiantly to rally his dispirited soldiers. But the 62nd Army he commanded existed in name only. Having been badly battered west of the Don, its survivors had straggled into Stalingrad to seek refuge, not combat. Its front extended from the tractor factory to the grain elevator, and it was ill-prepared to withstand the full weight of the oncoming Germans. An armored brigade possessed just one tank. An infantry brigade counted exactly 666 soldiers, of whom only 200 were qualified riflemen. A regiment which should have mustered 3,000 troops listed 100. The division next to it, normally 10,000 strong, had a total of 1,500. On the southern fringe of the city, the once great 35th Guards Division carried 250 infantry on its rolls. With these statistics confronting him, General Lopatin lost confidence in his ability to save Stalingrad. When he confided his fears to Yeremenko, he lost his job. Across the Volga, in the woods at Yami, Yeremenko and Khrushchev held a hurried conference to choose a successor. Sifting the names of candidates, they quickly agreed that one general, Vasily Ivanovich Chuikov, the deputy commander of the 64th Army, was best qualified for the job. A peasant whose career included work as a bellhop and shop apprentice before the Bolshevik Revolution, Chuikov had joined the Communist Party in 1919, and within months became leader of a regiment during the Civil War. 6 years later, at the age of 25, he graduated from the prestigious Frunze Military Academy and went on to command an army in the Russo-Finnish War of 1939 to 1940. When Hitler invaded the Soviet Union, Chuikov was stationed in Chongqing, China, reporting the palace intrigues around the fascist Chiang Kai-shek. Not until the spring of 1942 did he return to Russia, where, for the past 6 weeks, he had worked in General Shumilov's 64th Army as it fought the German 4th Panzer Army on the steppe southwest of Stalingrad. Despite the constant retreats before the massed enemy tanks, Chuikov never succumbed to defeatism. Strong-willed, imbued with a belief in himself, he heaped scorn on those who lost heart. Argumentative to a fault, he readily chastised anyone who disagreed with his ideas about military matters. His abrasive personality went hand in hand with his pugnacious appearance. Broad-shouldered, stocky, he had a jowly, seamed face. Tousled black hair fell into his eyes, and his smile revealed a row of gleaming gold teeth. Chuikov cared little about his dress, so ordinary and unkempt that he was frequently mistaken for the average foot soldier. Yeremenko and Khrushchev felt that Chuikov's dynamic manner far outweighed any deficiencies in temperament. Precisely because he was decisive, tenacious, and a brilliant improviser on the battlefield, they believed that he was the right man to send into Stalingrad. Yeremenko phoned Stalin on the Bodo line to get approval for the appointment, then called the general to Yami for a conference. On the evening of September 11th, Chuikov appeared at the main ferry landing in Stalingrad. While waiting for a steamer, he wandered into a first aid station and immediately became furious at what